everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political left, Shireen Gorbani.
Hello. Hi, listeners. Hope you're doing well.
And on the political right, John Dougal.
Great to be with you.
Yeah. You know, right before
spring day.
It is. And right before we start the program, I have this horrible kind of feeling like, oh, what are we going to talk about? You know, because it's got to come.
Because we always run
somewhere.
Out of material.
And we're recording this the day after the Canadian election.
Yes.
Mark Carney.
The 51st state? Sorry.
Listen, I was stunned on Sunday to hear the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, speaking to that. Because I've gotten to the point where President Trump can say things and you just kind of like let it float by. But when a consequential figure like the Secretary of State, who has a history that's not like Donald Trump, speaks like that, it makes me nervous. But
and what did Marco say?
Carney got it. He just said, you know, it's something that's being looked at. You know, he said it's on the table. And I'm just like, really? And, you know, you have this Prime Minister Carney saying, quote, our old relationship with the United States is over. That is such bad news to me.
Well, we can't trust him anymore. He said something along those lines, so, which is sad commentary.
It's super sad. And, you know, they use the term ham-fisted a lot to talk about the implementation of Trump policies. But this goes beyond ham-fisted to me.
Yes.
To take a northern neighbor that's fought with us at Normandy, that's been with us through thick and thin, and to treat him like this.
Yeah. And I have to say is also a big and important partner when it comes to issues of immigration.
Mm-hmm.
One of our biggest trade partners, right? Mm-hmm. When we think about trade, I think a lot of people think about China. They think about these emerging economies, but our neighbors are Mexico and China, Mexico and Canada are some of our biggest trade partners.
Yeah.
There is a lot of uncertainty that has unnecessarily been prompted by this president.
John, it reminds me of, I think of the relationship between Utah and California. California's 340 million. I'm getting that about right. Sorry, that's the U.S.
Yeah, that's
California's
the US.
34 million, about 10%.
Yeah, yep.
And we're 3.5 million, you know, but if California were making these kinds of statements about Utah, we'd be furious.
Oh, we'd be livid. Outraged. Yeah.
Yeah.
What gives? So,
I mean, I think there's some interesting things here. The Liberal Party was not doing well in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But they're back.
They're back.
Better than ever.
And they're back because of this sense of Canadians' outrage over what is happening with Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And Carney took a very strong position on that.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have given a little commentary about Mark Carney before.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about him?
Well, he's a globalist. He's known very well for his banking experience. He's sophisticated. He's pretty.
And you're saying globalist in a positive sense of the word.
I am. Yeah. I'm saying someone who has experience at the World Bank and who's, you know, understands international finance and understands world trade. And so in a lot of ways, he's President Trump's worst enemy because this guy's really good at what he does.
Yeah.
And he won't suffer fools.
Yeah.
This is my opinion.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
Well, this is one of those things. I mean, I'm not sure what Trump's desired outcome is from this whole situation. But here's, as Shireen said, a party that was in decline that all of a sudden was given new life as a result of the attention.
This is happening all around the world. So then we have the Pope's funeral and we have that classic photograph. It'll be one of the photographs of 2025 of President Trump and President Zelensky sitting in chairs talking to each other.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is history, you know, happening. And
wouldn't you like to know what they were really talking about?
Yeah, and it looked to me like there was some eye-to-eye things going on that were pretty good, which says something about human contact and brain science, that when you look eye-to-eye, how you behave and different things. But you also have the president, you know, I'm meaning President Trump, taking on Putin in ways he hasn't before, tweeting to stop, and then Putin doing this thing where he's asking for a 3-day ceasefire, please. Shireen, color commentary here.
Yeah, so I would just say this is a major disappointment, certainly of many from the Trump administration, but to see this turning of tides on Putin is good. I would like to see that continue.
Yeah.
I don't think it's reasonable to expect our president, President Trump, to have consistency really on any front. But the some of the deals that have been floated, mm-hmm. some of the things that have come out, I think actually it was J.D. Vance who released sort of a transitional plan that included giving a lot of Ukraine to Russia, mm-hmm. which is unacceptable. It's mm-hmm. just unacceptable. And I don't know exactly how we've gotten here, other than I believe that Putin has unbelievable sway over our government, over our, you know, top government officials.
Apparently.
And what I would like to see is us going back to supporting Ukraine.
Yeah. John, where do you come from a conservative point of view on this? I mean, conservatives are known for strong defense. They're known for protecting the world order. They're known for, you know, taking on tyrants around the world.
Well, I would say it depends.
Yeah.
When you look at history.
I was looking, you look like you were going to disagree with me.
When you look back at Reagan and stuff, absolutely, that's what Reagan stood for. Mm-hmm. But if you go further back in time, Republicans were isolationists. Mm-hmm. And it seems like we're reverting back to that.
Yeah. This is interesting because there's a lot of this. I agree with what you're saying. And there's a lot of context that is historical that's being brought to bear at a time like this, because it doesn't feel like North is North anymore. Mm-hmm. And then you start to realize, well, North used to be South and now it's North. And, you know, it's I agree with you.
Yeah. And one of my concerns is I don't think we should walk away and go isolationist. I didn't like our nation building pursuits. I thought that was injecting ourselves too much into trying to dictate to the world. Mm-hmm. I had concerns with us being the world's policeman. I think we needed to be out there for global security, but in partnership with many other countries. And so this is one of those things. It's like, you know, I know Trump's talked like he was going to bring a conclusion to this war in Ukraine in 24 hours, which clearly was not reality. And I wish people would actually look at what was said and what is done to see, you know, when the statements actually have merit and when they don't. But I think us isolating and trying to step away and thinking that Russia will abide by whatever peace terms, they don't have a history of showing that. And so therefore, I think Russia over time will continue to encroach and encroach and encroach and look to drag us in into a more serious conflict.
Yeah. Okay. So you can see the world's problems becoming Trump's problems. Mm-hmm. And he's in a point now where he has to own the economy and he also has to own the Russian-Ukraine war.
Or quickly will own it.
Yeah. And Shireen, we've hit 100 days.
We've hit 100 days. Yeah.
And the president this week is in, I believe it's in Michigan, visiting a plant, you know, celebrating his success in helping the working class. Probably will fall a little short of his ambitions because people are concerned. He's not winning on the economy.
No, he's not winning on the economy. And in fact, this is a president who has the worst approval rating at 100 days right now. Many people, you know, there have been a couple of polls released, have given him an F. Mm-hmm. And that is across the political spectrum, because I think what we do agree on largely is that the cost of living has not been addressed, that the chaos has actually been increased, that people do not like the amount of people who have lost their jobs and the backlogs that we're starting to see in government. There's a real sense of dissatisfaction with what's happening, and I think it's earned.
Yeah.
John, I don't think you can solve the economy in 100days. But
I think he said he could do it in one.
Hold on.
Chaos and stuff.
He didn't need to solve an economy. We went into this year with a very strong economy. He blew it up. He wasn't asked to solve the economy.
Folks were agitated with inflation, the cost of food and other things were going up.
2.4%. He came into a strong labor market with inflation coming under control and pretty bright future with deregulation and tax cuts, and he blew it up with his economic policies and tariffs.
This is where the chaos, I think, is the biggest problem. I do not want a government of unpredictability, whether I like it or not. I want a government that says, that's where I'm going, calls it shot, and marches in that direction, because then I can see and I can react based on where it's going, rather than this willy-nilly turmoil and churn and uncertainty that causes people to be unclear about what's going on, causes business owners to sit on the sidelines and not invest like they should be.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to agree and disagree, John. I completely agree that the uncertainty will be probably worse than the tariffs. You know, that the chaos that's been created may be worse than the tariffs. But I will also double down that the tariffs are bad.
Oh.
The tariffs are not helpful.
No.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Even if he was really good in his implementation of them, they are a broad-based tax on American consumers and on the inputs to manufacture products, and they don't help our economy.
And you and I are free trade people. And so we totally agree on that.
Shereen, you know this, but I've been like reading my old economics textbooks.
Yeah.
And I started with the principles textbook, and then I went to a macro, and then I went to a micro, and then I went to intermediate macro and intermediate micro. Anyway, they're all the same on this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Super interesting.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting time because the complexity of some of these kind of global trade issues, I think tariffs, understanding that tariffs are a tax on the American people mm-hmm. is something we get now.
Yeah.
And I think if you had asked people 6 months ago to really talk about what a tariff was, mm-hmm. I don't know that they would have been able to articulate it. But I think what I would love to leave our listeners with on this issue is that we should take this president at face value. Mm-hmm. When he says something, especially when he repeats it, he means it. Mm-hmm. Whether it's a good idea or not, you mm-hmm. can expect it to be enacted as policy. That's the Trump doctrine.
But he'll also change.
He'll change, but you start to get the sense he's got a riff. He's got a gig that he does.
Well,
and when he starts doing it, that's the direction we're going.
When I was listening to a podcast the other day, Tyler Cowen, an economist, talking about the great forgetting, talking about how something that we took for granted that was just everybody recognized and understood in the 80s, we have seemed to have forgotten this, that, and the other.
Yeah, like public education.
Today.
Or the peaceful transfer of power. That's an example that comes to mind for me.
Hey, all right. John, you're sitting here in a studio with two women. The data on the president's approval ratings are abysmal among women. Mm-hmm. They're abysmal among women, and they're abysmal among young. And I just thought it'd be fun to just end this segment by commenting on that. Because
and they're pretty poor also among swing voters.
Yeah.
I mean, those that were hardcore, but independents.
But white men are holding solid, y'all.
Yeah.
I don't resemble that comment.
All right. Let's take a short break and we'll be right back. Natalie Gochner with John Dougal and Shereen Gourbani. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shereen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and we've got a few more things we want to cover. And one of them I want to talk about, very local, but the referendum to repeal the anti-union law. We got news that it met the signature threshold requirements. No surprise there. They have a boatload of signatures.
They do.
How does this play out, Shereen?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. So basically what happened is that there was a very high signature threshold. This is one of the most difficult states in the union to get a referendum going. About 150,000 signatures were required, and they had to be over 8% or something like that.
Yeah, 8% of the registered voters in different
15 Senate districts.
Yeah.
Now, this, I would say, is a benefit of the way we've been gerrymandered because I think 11 Senate districts are in Salt Lake County. So there is a huge opportunity to really drive up the number.
I didn't even think of that. But Shereen, of course, you know that.
So the number that was turned in.
Can I just add to that? So what that's saying is that it's easy to get signatures. It's hard to get them in all the districts you need to get them in.
Yeah.
And if all the districts were pushed off the Wasatch Front, it'd be harder, but they're concentrated.
But I should say it wasn't necessarily harder because if you go and look at the distribution of where these signatures came in, they came in all over the state. Mm-hmm. Because I do think that in general, this state believes that it's already a right to work state. You don't have to join a union. If you are going to further decimate working people's power, that is bad. I think the sentiment here is that people don't like it.
Yeah.
So 320,000 signatures were turned in, and they have now met the threshold across the 15 Senate districts. Now, what I think is interesting here is the last time this happened, I'm going to forget, but it was a few years ago, and it was around tax policy. And the signatures were collected, and the legislature called themselves into session and undid the law, right? So are we going to see...
It's about the sales tax on food.
Sales tax on food. Are we going to see that again?
Yeah.
Will they call themselves in? And I think the other interesting piece about this is the last referendum was 2007, and it was in response to the state's first voucher program. So the last time that a referendum went through was, again, tied to our schools. So I think the perception and the story that we're being told from the legislature and the way that Utahns feel about their neighborhood schools, about teachers, about firefighters in their communities is different than what we're hearing from the legislature.
I know we have a disagreement here on the right, John, because you liked this bill.
I did like this bill. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's appropriate for government to have to negotiate with unions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look at FDR, and even he was opposed to government unions. And that's what we're talking about here. We are not talking about private sector unions mm-hmm. and that type of activity. And it's because they have an unfair way to negotiate. Governments don't go away. Businesses, mm-hmm. you have to balance. Are you going to be a viable business when you're negotiating with the union? In government, you're feeding at the taxpayer trough. You're forcing, in essence, taxes to be higher as a result of this. And so it's not a fair negotiation. And I don't think, raising sales tax on food, highly unpopular. I mean, I warned the legislature about that before they did it. I don't think this has the same level of angst among the general populace.
The actual lived outcome, though, of what you're saying is, I just heard maybe 6 months ago, Governor Cox talking about how proud he was that they've now moved the salary for teachers, I think first-year teachers, to about $59,000 a year. So the outsized control that you're suggesting that these unions have has resulted in somebody making about $60,000 a year as a first-year teacher in a state that's largely unaffordable.
Are you saying the unions were about raising teacher pay? Because they were not. So, the unions, I mean, teacher friends of mine, when I've talked to them about when is the union going to fix their pay problem, they're like, never. Why not? Because as soon as they fix it, I don't need them. This was over.
Understand that firefighters are not being paid exorbitant amounts in our state. Cops are not being paid in ways that I think the communities would find shocking. And in fact, we know that it's hard to recruit people to work in many of these jobs. So giving people a fighting chance to work in these government jobs and have a living wage is something that a lot of people around the state would like to see.
But the unions will pitch to their members, join us because we'll fix your pay, but they won't fix the pay.
Do y'all remember
the last time
we had a strike among public employees? Can you even recall one?
Well, we had the walkout from teachers back, about 24 years ago?
Yeah, I remember this one. That's the only one. I wondered if you were here yet, and you probably weren't born.
No, I wasn't. I was in Utah, but I was not in the legislature at that time.
I was working on Capitol Hill. Bangor was governor, if I remember right. So it may have been more than 24 years ago. But in any case, we're looking at each other having a memory. But the issue is...
I was thinking it was Leavitt, but yeah.
I also remember, this is back when I'm in like junior high, but I remember when the air traffic controllers went on strike and Reagan clamped down on it. You know, and so I get John's point about how public employees are essential services. And, you know, the idea of them walking off the job really troubles me. But it felt like this bill went a bitch too far. And it'll be interesting to see the legislature's next move.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to also talk about this merging of the Forward Party and the United Utah Party.
Yeah.
So the way this came into my world is Christy Todd Whitman was in town this weekend. She's the former governor of New Jersey. She was EPA administrator. Because I'd worked at EPA, I knew she was in town. But she was in town because she's part of the Forward Party with Andrew Yang.
Yes. Yeah.
They co-chair this. And the United Utah Party, Michelle Quist is the chair. They joined forces.
So I do think this is the first time this has happened, which is a little bit of a moment in Utah history. Mm-hmm. Political parties joining together to create one party. So now there is one, I think, elected state senator maybe in the country that... Mm-hmm. And that's Senator Thatcher.
Yeah.
And I think there is an appetite for...
Elected as a Republican, but then left
switch
the
party.
Republican Party.
And not going to run again, right. At least at this time with this seat. So
yeah, well,
that complicates it.
But. Yeah, but point of the story is that I think that there is an appetite. There has been for a long time, whether it's the Green Party, Democratic Socialists,
Libertarian Constitution Party. Lots of third parties.
Yeah, lots of third parties. But this is an interesting one because I think what they're trying to pitch is space in the middle. And there are a lot of Utahns who I think are looking for a political home there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to see.
Do you think they're going
to
be successful, though? I mean, this is one of those things, struggling to find. I mean, there's a lot of Utahns that say, I want to be independent, I'm unaffiliated, yet they naturally align with one of the two major parties.
Yeah, I think what's going to happen, I think what's happening more and more that I'm seeing from the perspective where I stand is that fewer and fewer people are really interested in running for office because it is such a difficult, taxing, expensive endeavor. What I like about this, I think what it gives the opportunity for is to start at the ground level, talking about school boards, municipal elections, getting involved at that kind of base level and building up. But I do think that takes a long time. I think the question really is, how do we create an environment where our best and brightest really want to be in office?
Yeah. Okay, let's switch it a little bit. Let's talk about higher education and the cuts or reallocation of funds. Weber State University's out the gate quickly. They're going to eliminate, Shireen, 49 positions. 11 are administrative. They also have 28 faculty positions that are cut, 10 staff positions, saving $4.7 million. This is President Brad Mortensen. Wow. He's being aggressive here.
Yeah.
Your reaction to it?
My reaction is you have to be aggressive in the political climate that we live in this state. There has been a disinvestment in higher education. I think a lot of it is driven by political backlash. I think the real question is how and are we able to support the needs of our students to really invest in the kind of future and building the, you know, the kind of educated workforce and also just communally minded people that the state needs.
Yeah.
Did he say what degrees or program? I didn't see that in the news story.
Not that I have seen. And you got to think, if you're doing 28 faculty positions, that's a lot. So that's not going to be in one discipline. That's going to be in multiple disciplines. But, you know, John, I'm curious what you think here. But I think this is President Mortensen basically saying we're being responsive. We're following what the state leaders, we're a state institution. We're following what state leaders ask. But there's going to be more written here. Because for every cut you've made, somebody's impacted by it. And then that kind of plays out and has ripples. And my big question would be, if we need to be more efficient, why aren't we doing that anyway?
Well, my argument is these institutions should have been doing this all along, not waiting for a legislative mandate.
Yeah. And so the legislature says, listen, you know, we got to put this discipline on you to optimize your systems. And that's happening.
And optimization means this, get rid of the degrees that are really expensive that aren't educating many students. Mm-hmm. And then we'll reallocate that money that you've saved to other more important activities within your institutions is kind of a big picture.
Yeah, and importantly, they're thinking of a system. So you don't have to get rid of all degrees, let's say Russian speaking, you know, languages, whatnot. Just have them at one institution rather than multiple.
Right.
That kind of thing. So we have more systems thinking rather than everybody trying to be a four-year university that offers everything.
Everything to everyone, and it costs way too much.
Yeah. I've heard people say—
folks are concerned about the cost of higher ed, not just the tax burden, but the tuition costs for students and families.
Yeah. It's pretty well known in this state that we basically do not have a community college system.
Right.
That we've let all of our community colleges become four-year universities.
Almost all of it,
super expensive choice. And you wonder if, you know, that was the right thing.
Yeah. I guess I'll just go back to, I think there is some logic in consolidating some of these programs. As a person who in my master's had a little extra time at the University of Nebraska and took Arabic because I was interested in it. It was, I think, the only school in Nebraska that offered Arabic. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of people in that class. Right. Mm-hmm. And when you think about the opportunities to really learn a language or learn about culture, you get a much richer experience when there's not just two other people in the class. Right. So there is some logic here and there could be some long term benefits. I would just ask that, are we being thoughtful in the way that we are supporting education and really being expansive in our thinking about what different degrees allow people to do and think about in the future that I think is largely difficult to decipher from the place where we sit now.
Mm-hmm.
That arts education, degrees in languages, degrees in philosophy may matter more on a horizon that a lot of people can't see.
Interesting. We're getting a lot of immigration news, and Channel 5, KSL, is doing a feature all week long on the Utah Compact. I've watched two of them so far. Interesting. Do you know much about that, John? Utah Compact? This was
I was in the legislature at the time.
This is the five principles to guide Utah's immigration discussion. And basically KSL saying, are they still in place?
Applicable.
They went to D.C. and asked our congressional delegation, and they agreed. It made me happy.
Wouldn't it be nice if they did something about it?
So we did have Senator Curtis, who said last week that he's concerned about the deportation policies of the president. He's particularly concerned about Mr. Garcia. But quick comment, Shireen, on Utah Compact or deportations, immigration.
Yeah, and the frustration that I have here with the actual people who could do something about this, basically continuing to just kick. It feels like lip service to me, and I would like to see action.
Yeah.
I want to see us expand the legal doorway for folks to come in.
Love it.
Make that easier and harder for folks to come in illegally.
Yeah.
I want folks that want to live a better life.
This is like
have a safer place to raise their family. Not somebody that wants to live on welfare or commit crime.
Immigration reform, and I don't think we've had immigration reform since Reagan was in office. This is a Reagan program.
Yep. And there, I just have to reiterate that there was a not complete, but a step in the right direction at the end of the Biden administration. Trump killed it. And Republicans, some of these very people who were interviewed, our representatives, were part of the group that did not let this go forward. And it is deeply disappointing. And I just find it unbelievably frustrating.
Yeah, that's tough. Hey, I'm just going to read a short tribute to end out the program. Judith Billing. She's a decade after graduating from law school, she was selected as one of seven judges to sit on the Utah Court of Appeals when it was created almost 40 years ago. One of two women in the inaugural class of appellate judges. She died this month at 82 years of age.
Condolences to her family.
Yeah. I did not know this judge, but she was a pathfinder for women. So very good. Okay, everyone. Great program. This is Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gorbani and John Dougal. The program is produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.